Hello everyone and welcome to Hashtag Team Early Childhood Podcast. This week we are interviewing Helen Moylett. Hello Helen.
Hello.
Are you okay?
I'm absolutely fine, yeah.
Good. Thank you for coming to join us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Aaron, having seen your other podcasts and things. I'm feeling a bit overawed, but I'll do my best.
Well, everybody knows the style of the podcast that we have. And basically, I have six questions. You've seen some of the questions, haven't you, Helen? Everybody knows that we share the questions prior to the podcast, which means that you can prepare. And everyone gets the same question at the end, which is question six around your wishes. So without further ado, Helen, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, well, I mean, I've been around for a long time, and sometimes when I'm being introduced at a conference and somebody goes through my entire biography, I always hope that people are looking at me and thinking, gosh, she doesn't look old enough to have done all of that.
I'm not sitting there thinking,
oh, that explains why she looked so old and knackered. But anyway, I have had quite an interesting career, I think. Well, it's been really interesting for me and I'm still in it. I started, once I qualified as a primary school teacher, teaching much older children in what were then called top juniors. Right. But I got absolutely fascinated by how children learn to read and do things like manipulate numbers. The reading was just a puzzle to me because I'd never struggled with reading as a child, but I struggled with maths big time all the way through my school career. And the key for me was when, I mean, it was a horrible school. The head teacher was vile and I'd got no support as a newly qualified teacher. But I decided I was going to do something a bit out of the box. And we made a huge, great, more than life-size statue of the Incredible Hulk. Because at that time in the 70s, that was the first incarnation of the Incredible Hulk. And we made that as a class and we entered it for this competition at the local cinema, one of the cinemas in inner city Manchester. That's where I was working. And we won and we got tickets to go and see the film of the Incredible Hulk. It was all terribly exciting. And I realised that during that process, we'd been talking, we'd been really creative. The children and their parents had been involved in bringing things in to make this thing. I hadn't a clue what we were doing with chicken wire and bits of old broomstick and all sorts of things. And but I thought, yeah, the key to these children being excited about education and getting their parents involved seemed to be talk and doing creative things. So that started me on a voyage of inquiry about, you know, how do children learn and all of those things. I got the chance to leave that horrible school and go and work in an open plan school in a reception class. Now, bearing in mind that I'd had no training in early years and I had no idea what I was doing. That was quite a big thing to do. But I absolutely loved it when I got over the fact that these children didn't sit down for half an hour and do what they were told. And that they did things like stroke your legs while you were reading them a story and try to swing in and things like that. It all was a bit of a shock, and I made loads of mistakes. But the thing that I loved was that the children seemed to like me and I certainly liked them. And we seemed to be getting some learning done. I mean, I was certainly doing a lot of learning and I hope they were. And then I got a chance to work in the nursery. The nursery teacher and I did a bit of swapsies and things. And I joined the local branch of BASE, what's now Early Education, and met some really inspiring early years people who just turned me onto it all. You know, I thought, now I understand it. And I was in that lovely school for a while. Actually, at some point, I had to leave early years because we had a bit of staffing crisis. I had to go and teach juniors again, which I loved because, you know, I just like teaching. But, you know, early years was where my heart was. And I left that school eventually and went to be a homeschool teacher, teaching throughout the primary school and working with parents. And also, as part of that, setting up a toddler group, another completely like under threes. I didn't have any of my own children at this point. I was completely clueless. We were in a totally unsuitable room. I was with a lot of very distressed mums and I could cope with that. I knew about working with parents by then. You know, I was sort of tuned into a lot of that stuff. But the under threes were a complete mystery. So again, I threw myself on the mercy of a lot of very interesting people in early years in BASE and Leslie Abbott, who I'd met, who worked at what was then Manchester Poly. And I really loved the homeschool work and I nearly left teaching altogether at that point and became a community worker because I was working with the local community workers and the play therapists. And we had such a great time and I loved it so much. I learned so much. I did a lot of counselling skills courses and things around that time. And I nearly left education, formal education altogether. And it was only my inspirational head teacher who kept me in, actually, and said, no, you know, actually, we need more teachers like you who've got a broader perspective on things. And I thought, oh, maybe, maybe. So I stayed for a bit, and then I got seconded to the local authority to do some research on play throughout the primary school. And I've always been passionate about play. And I did a research diploma and some part-time, part of that, and it was all paid for in those days, by the local authority. I did a research diploma, which really helped me in terms of becoming a researcher. And I also did this project for the local authority, looking at play in various primary schools, including my own, all the way through primary, from, you know, the little ones in nursery to year six.
Yeah.
And I absolutely loved it. And I didn't go back to my school after that. I became a local authority advisor on what was the Manchester Early Literacy Project. Wow. So, you know, my my passion for play, literacy, language and all of those things coming together. And unfortunately, that coincided with Manchester running into the most horrendous debt problems because of the left-wing council and all sorts of political shenanigans going on.
Yeah.
So I was actually about to get the sack when I got a phone call from what was then Manchester Poly, where I'd done a little bit of part-time tutoring for them while I was doing my diploma, saying, we've got a full-time job, would you like to apply for it? And I thought, well, yes, please. So I ended up going to Manchester Poly as a lecturer, but it soon became Manchester Metropolitan University.
Yeah.
And I had the really great fortune of working with Leslie Abbott, who was an inspirational early years leader. She set up one of the first, not the first, I think Carolyn Silberfeld has that distinction, of the Childhood Studies degrees. And I ended up being the course leader of the BA in Early Childhood Studies for a while. Which was a great experience, as well as teaching on the BEd, the PGCE, having students out in school, being in charge of school experience placements as well for a while, and teaching on the MEd. And did a lot of work with under threes there as well, because I loved that. And we were doing a lot of research on under threes. And of course, that research led to Birth to Three Matters in the end.
Right.
And around that time when Birth to Three Matters was sort of being developed, I left MMU because I got, it was Chris and Tony actually at CREC who were largely responsible for me leaving MMU, because I was working, I was an evaluator for the Early Excellence Centre programme as part of my research bit of what I was doing at MMU. And I interviewed Chris and Tony and many other people, heads of these new Early Excellence Centres, etc., and thought, I'm fed up with academia. I actually want to go back to working with children, and I would love to be in one of these integrated centres. So I applied for a job in one. And I became the head of the first Early Years Centre in Staffordshire. So I moved south and became that the head teacher of Tamworth Early Years Centre, which was a fantastic experience because it brought together a nursery school, social services, you know, it became a children's centre, all of those things. Wonderful experience. And while I was there, I was still having that link with Birth to Three Matters, and we became part of the Birth to Three Matters research programme at Tamworth, which was great. And I was also doing the national training and all of that. I stayed there for a while, for a few years, and then I joined the National Strategies and got involved in developing the EYFS and became the national lead for the Every Child a Talker programme as well. So I've done quite a lot of things, which are around the passion for young children. And of course, in 2011, we all got made redundant from the national strategy because we got a new government and every child no longer mattered, apparently, because every child mattered got banned, didn't it? That's something you said. And I became an independent consultant. And what I've been doing since then is, well, I got involved in writing development matters. That was interesting. But, you know, mainly just sort of doing things that people asked me to do around training and consultancy in early years. And I still love early years. I'm still passionate about it. And I keep thinking, you know, I'm past any decent sort of retirement age, really. So I should really just go home and say enough. But actually, I just love it. And I feel like I have the luxury of being able to spend time looking at the big picture, really, because when you're immersed in it all, you don't have that time. So anyway, that's enough.
I just think it's really interesting because, you know, I listened to you speak at the Brewed online the weekend, and it's so, you know, I think that what came through with your, it is the experience and the rigor that you've got, and actually that experience that you brought to the Brewed was just phenomenal. And we all, you know, we all left your session just thinking, yes, we can do it.
We can. We can. Have to believe that.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I knew about, you know, Development Matters, and I know that you've worked obviously with Chris and Tony and all those, but what a journey, you know. I just think it's just amazing where it all began, and you know, and you're still very much part of that. You know, well, it hasn't ended, you know, that's the most important thing. It hasn't ended.
Oh, no.
You know, and you're still carrying on, which is fantastic. So you've kind of answered question one, really, because question one was tell us about your journey. So I think you've told us about your journey.
Yeah.
But why is early childhood so important to you, Helen? Like, what would be the most important aspects of why early childhood?
It's there. That's us. We are all walking histories of our early childhood, really. And actually, when you ever look at anyone, you know, any developmental psychologist, say people like Alison Gopnik or Carol Dweck, you know, who are famous developmental psychologists, start looking at human behaviour, they quite often start with older people, and they always end up in early childhood.
Yeah.
Because whenever you start looking, that's where it all starts. We write the scripts, and we have them written for us as well by adults, obviously, of who we become. And all that we know all now about neuroscience and brain development, you know, tells us that actually this is the most important time of life.
Yeah. I mean, neuroscience is really kind of coming into its own now, isn't it, really? And
absolutely,
we're becoming a lot more informed around the brain, you know, and the brain architecture, and it's a fantastic time to really kind of just take that step back, really, and think about, you know, where does it all begin?
Exactly.
You know, we've definitely moved on. Okay, so question number two is about a document called Getting It Right in the EYFS. So why is this such an important document, Helen?
Oh, I want it to be, like, you know, something that every single person in early years has read, or at least read the recommendations, because it's not that long, but it's pretty dense. So that's why I decided I really wanted to talk about it, because my experience tells me, from talking to practitioners, even people who have been working with me on the MA at CREC, who are very interested in things like that, in research, etc., that most of them haven't read it, because although they know it might exist, they don't know why, you know, it's there and what it's about. And there are two real reasons why it's really important for me. One reason, the first reason, is how it came about. And the second one is basically what's in it, of course. So if I just say something about how it came about, because I think it's really crucial. I mean, the EYFS, we're talking about the EYFS here because it's called Getting It Right in the EYFS, a review of the evidence. So, you know, it's evidence-based. It came about because, of course, the EY, you know, the EYFS, we know, is a principled set of commitments, really, and principles that help us to deliver good quality early years care and education for young children. And the current version was carefully constructed after the Tickell review, which was also research informed, etc. So, you know, and it was a long time ago, so a review is timely. But the government have introduced a review without consulting with the sector. And some people are not aware of that, but actually in July 2018, the DfE published what they presented as the EYFS reforms. Yes. Whenever I see that term reforms, I put it in inverted commas, because there's no way this is reform. But anyway, now, you know, quite a lot of people were quite surprised about it, because they said it was a review of the early learning goals. But in fact, it was a comprehensive rewrite of the entire statutory framework, including the educational programmes for each area of learning. So that's quite a big deal.
Yes.
And it happened because the DfE claimed a mandate to do that based on the primary, not early years, assessment consultation, which was launched in 2017. Now, that consultation sought views on various aspects of primary assessment. So needless to say, most early years people did not respond to it, because when you label something primary, you know, you think, well, that's got nothing to do with me. But actually, embedded in there were they were asking for views about the profile. So it applied to primary in terms of reception, and, you know, how the profile could be improved to better assess child development and school readiness at five. And the majority of people who responded, which weren't many early years people, supported a commitment to retain the profile, but wanted it to be improved. Okay. They also included baseline in there as well, but I don't really like baseline today because it infuriates me. And
one aspect I was just going to say was it was around about the same time as baseline. So
exactly. Well, that was starting to come into one, isn't it? Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But neither the scope of the primary assessment consultation or the responses to it provided a mandate to review the whole of the EYFS. However, they just carried on. So there were a few, you know, worries about this, needless to say, because actually you don't review a framework by starting at the end of phase assessment before reviewing the curriculum for the whole lot, I think. So, you know, needless to say, the document they produced was absolutely dire. And unfortunately, looks like it's going to be like that in some way or other. But anyway, their stated intentions, which were supposed to make it more palatable, were they wanted to reduce workload, particularly for reception teachers, and improve children's language and communication skills, which is one of those government aims that they keep bandying about particularly for disadvantaged children. But I mean, they were put completely at risk. If you want to reduce workload by producing a whole new framework, you know, since when does ever producing a whole new framework for people to get their heads around, the whole sector, by the way, not just reception teachers, reduce workload? That is a really weird thing. And also, I mean, actually what's in that statutory, the redrafted statutory framework, is not going to improve communication and language for anyone, never mind disadvantaged children or however you characterise them. So basically, this EY, Early Years Coalition, came together in adversity because, you know, all these organisations were sort of realising what was happening, throwing up their hands in horror and saying, oh, my God, what can we do? So Early Education, the Early Childhood Forum, the Early Childhood Studies Degrees Network, the Early Years Alliance, Keeping Early Years Unique, Montessori, the National Children's Bureau, the NDNA, PACE, the Sector Endorsed Foundation Degrees in the Early Years, the British Early Childhood Education Research Association, the British Association for Educational Research, and Froebel, to name nearly every organisation you can think of in early years, all came together in this big coalition. And there were a few other people, the unions involved, like the NASU, WT, NEU, etc., and the Teaching Schools Council were observers to all of this. And they came together as a coalition and said, look, we have to do something about this. We have to produce something to counter this. So that's where this review came from, because basically it's our response. It's the unity of our diverse sector against what is essentially a government attack on the EYFS. That's why it's important. You know, our EYFS is being attacked by a government who knows nothing about early years.
And did they acknowledge that review? Had the government come back to the coalition and
take it into account? Right. And that's another reason why it's important, because the more we know about it, the more we can see when they produce, because at the end of June they're supposed to be producing their response to the consultation on their proposals. And they've said they will take this into account. Now that does not sound to me like a ringing endorsement, does it to you? I mean, it's a landmark to be able to get all those organisations together in the first place, because, we know what the we are a wonderful sector, and part of the wonder is our diversity, but it also makes it really difficult for us to act together because we've got various different and competing interests going on.
Yeah, we have. Well, we talked about that at the Bruet, didn't we?
When
you're a membership organisation, it's very, very different when you're a non-membership organisation. So to get everyone around the table
I have to pay tribute to Beatrice Merrick, who is the chief executive of Early Education, who did that. You know, she was the one who convened the group, managed to get them all together, because she has a very good, quiet way of winning people over, which is what you need in this, to say we've got this, we've got a common cause here, basically. And the other reason, of course, that it's really important is that what's in it, because actually the coalition came together and noted that what was important about the EYFS and the reason for its success in many ways was it's firmly based on research. Yeah. And it was drawn up and reviewed in consultation and co-production with the sector. So they decided to take the lead in this and review the recent research evidence, but also to do a practitioner survey about the EYFS, which had more than 3,000 responses, which I'm not going to talk about today, but is also very important. So, you know, there's some, it's basically an incredibly important document because it's got all the recent research evidence in it. And it's got some extremely strong recommendations as well. So
cool. Well, we can attach that document to your podcast as well.
Oh, that's good. And
make sure
that's
that everybody, you know, I'll say if you're listening to the podcast, make sure you read. It might be worth, I know you talked about some recommendations. It might be worth taking, like you say, just taking those recommendations out so that people can read them.
Yes, I mean it's very easy to do that because there's some nice, and also, I mean, what we could also put on there, Aaron, I don't know whether that's possible, is Chris, because it was written, they commissioned Chris and Tony from CREC and their postdoctoral research student Liz Rouse to do it.
Yeah.
And Chris and I think Tony as well produced some really interesting good slides to go with it actually. So I mean, we could put those on there.
That would be really great if we could get hold available. Of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That leads us on to question three, because obviously it's still. So can you tell us about some of the key recommendations and their implications for practice?
I can, and there's so much in it. But I mean, there were two overarching research questions that this review was based on. And one was, how far does the rationale for the prime and specific areas and the characteristics of effective learning reflect current knowledge about early learning and teaching? Okay, that was the first question. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was, what aspects of the EYFS are affirmed and what need adjustment based on evidence from the last 10 years? Okay, so it's basically saying, you know, is the EYFS still fit for purpose? Right. Is it still based on current research? Are there things we need to look at? And the headline finding, now this is just a headline, okay, was that there is no substantiated case for the EYFS statutory framework to be significantly changed. Okay, so basically it's still okay. Mm. However, there was a little bit of a but. Less advantaged children continue to underachieve, and this perpetuates the gap as they progress into primary schooling. Given this context, a closer examination of the recent evidence reveals that with some modifications, particularly in relation to the guidance on communication and language development, and giving greater prominence to the characteristics of effective teaching and learning, these children might be better served.
Right.
So you might, having heard that, expect me to look particularly at the recommendations around the characteristics and communication and language. But actually, I thought I'd quite like to pick out something a bit broader than that, because I'm always a bit concerned at the moment about terms like less advantaged and disadvantaged that get bandied about, and we assume we know who we're talking about. And actually, when we make assumptions like that, we get into all sorts of traps and, you know, deficit models of children. So what I'd really like to pick out is one of the things that they said as an action point. In fact, I think it's a combination of two action points, really. But I thought, there are lots of really interesting stuff about how we can make the characteristics and communication and language, but also all the other areas of learning more important and based on play and creativity and things. So, but one of the things they said was the diversity of learners must be recognised within all teaching content. Teaching content needs to equally recognise life experiences, right? Yeah. So that's one of the things they talked about. And I was just thinking, well, for instance, right now, we know that institutionalised racism in our systems has led to a disproportionate number of people from Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups dying of COVID, for instance. Mm. And those people who've died are from families who are using early years settings. So we're talking about children being affected by prejudice and discrimination. This afternoon, the government's voting on free school meals.
Yeah.
continuing in the school holidays for children who would normally get them. And, you know, I think without the intervention of people like Marcus Rashford, who's done an amazing job saying, you know, this is not okay, this is my experience as a child of a poor family, you know, it just, it underlined for me, thinking about this, that actually, yeah, we need to just have another think about, you know, how do we recognise diversity? How do we think about, for instance, different family structures and summer-born children? You know, big deal, particularly as they're coming up to the end of reception. How do we think about children with SEN and disabilities? And how do we recognise all children's cultural capital? That's one of the things also struggling about. So I just thought, yeah, this is quite a little bit of a rallying call.
Or their misunderstanding of what cultural capital is.
Oh, well, let's start on that. If anyone's interested in my views on that, I wrote a blog for Early Education, which is on the website about it. Because actually, I think it's gravely disrespectful of children to take on that national curriculum definition of cultural capital being about knowledge of all the best that has been thought and said. Now, who says what's the best that's been thought and said is? I mean, I think I say some very important things sometimes, but I also know that when I was three, I thought I was saying important things, and I was. So, you know, actually, you know, we need to take notice of what children bring to us.
Yeah.
And the other thing that they said, having taken that into account, that, you know, we need to have a bit of a think about diversity here. I mean, they didn't say all the things I've just said, but, you know, I just think... They did say effective pedagogic practice is the same for disadvantaged children as it is for all children. Now, that is true. There is no evidence that a different or more intense teaching approach is required. There is strong evidence that those children do, as do their peers, need more opportunities for play, language consolidation, and extension and opportunities to develop their wider learning dispositions and capacities. So in other words, the characteristics and communication and language are important because they're important for everybody.
Yeah.
So I would say to people, please read those sections, but don't forget all the other areas of learning. And also the coalition picked out four recommendations based on the entire research report, which I thought was a great feat, really. Because there are lots of recommendations and action points and things all the way through it. But the coalition, having, you know, as a group of organisations, read the whole thing, came up with four recommendations. And they said that the government should base, and this is what I think we need to remember, the Early Years Coalition, all those organisations, said that when the government revised the EYFS, they should bear in mind the following principles. And there were these four recommendations. Recognising the central importance of the characteristics, which has been emphasised by the growing body of research on self-regulation and executive function. Supporting the current emphasis on the prime areas within the EYFS is particularly crucial and time sensitive in the early years, and their foundational nature in relation to all later learning, including the importance of communication and language skills. Acknowledging the premise that all areas of learning are interconnected, demonstrating the holistic nature of young children's development. And the fourth one is the really killer one, I think. I want to, you know, go and stamp it on Nick Gibbs' forehead. Noting there is no evidence to support giving mathematics and literacy greater emphasis than any other areas of learning within the EYFS.
Yeah.
So... You know, I think even if we...
Well, the reality is mathematics and you know, language and communication is intertwined in everything that the child does. So it shouldn't be given, you know.
I know,
It's this whole schoolification kind of rhetoric coming through, isn't it?
It's the pressure, particularly on reception teachers. Now, we are a divided sector, and quite often schoolification... is used as a sort of, well, and quite rightly, as something which we don't want to see in the early years. But I mean, we have to be realistic and realise that many of our colleagues are working within that school system. And schoolification is a bad thing if it denies children the right to an early years foundation stage based on the characteristics which include play and creating and thinking critically and being active in your learning and being, you know, all of those things. But the problem, I mean, I think we need to be really, really supportive of our reception colleagues, because the problem we've got is, if we're not careful, is we'll say, well, we don't want anything to do with schools. But of course, our reception colleagues are under huge pressure. If you are, you know, in a primary school where there's no nursery class and you are the only reception teacher, the pressure on you to become, to make your reception class like year one, rather than like anything that you might recognise as an early years foundation stage classroom, is huge. So,
well, you haven't got your allies, have you, for a start? No. You know, you've got, so,
yeah. Exactly. And I mean, you know, in some schools, it is dire. And, you know, it's giving reception teachers the courage to say, no, you know, this is what we should be doing. And also for head teachers to take some note. I mean, it's difficult. Yeah. I talk to quite a lot of head teachers, and I am always amazed at the depths of ignorance of what actually they should be expecting in early years. And the trouble is that I suspect I only teach to those who are willing to be converted, because they're the ones who might come to some training about UIFS, or, you know, something that maybe their union, the NHT, has put on for them around, you know, young children's learning and development, or, you know, they're already sort of realising they need to know more. It's the ones who don't realise that they need that worry me.
Okay, so that review is quite powerful. You know, we're all party to it, and we want people to read it. But could you pinpoint a piece of research that kind of everyone could relate to?
Which, yes,
everyone could read.
Loads, but I have managed to choose one.
Okay.
Oh, there are so many. I mean, the good thing about it is, if you're interested in early years research, it is the place to look. Because unfortunately, when Ofsted, for instance, decided that they were going to be research informed, which is all good, you know, I have to applaud Ofsted for saying they were going to do that. Then we had a look, you know, as they were going to produce the new statutory framework, at their research review. And if you went through that, trying to pick out any early years research, that was very scant, and relied on things like EPI, which is so well known, you know, it's a big longitudinal study, which is great. I mean, you know, nothing wrong with it. In fact, there's lots right with it. But I mean, it's only one. And if you looked for SEND, that was also another area which was missing. So, you know, this is a research review that actually has the research we need to know about. And I actually picked out of it something in a section that I wished everyone really should read, which is about special, it's called, the section is entitled, the whole section is entitled Pedagogical Approaches. And it's actually 3.6. The question is, what pedagogic approach best supports a child to achieve a good level of development throughout the UIFS and enables them to achieve their potential? And they talk about some pedagogical approaches based on research. And if anyone's interested, there's another interesting discussion going on around that between Chris and Tony and Julie Fisher on Thursday.
Yeah,
it's part of the CREC Learning Circle, because Chris and Tony talk about something called hybrid pedagogies, which is basically bringing together, you know, direct instruction and play-based, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot in that section which is really interesting, whichever age group you teach, around pedagogy. How do we actually teach? And I'm not suggesting that teaching is not about play, because actually that's what the whole section is about. How do you weave the importance of children's playing into what you provide for them every day and your own teaching? We're all teachers of children.
Yeah.
All adults are, you know, from birth, children are learning from us. So having said that, one of the things that I thought was a really good article, which I remember when it came out thinking it was brilliant, is by Pat Broadhead. And what she does is bring together a lot of things, because actually the article is called Conflict Resolution and Children's Behaviour, Observing and Understanding Social and Cooperative Play in Early Years Educational Settings. Now, I wouldn't necessarily suggest that you might want to read the whole article, because it's quite long, but it's really interesting. It's actually very readable. I mean, it's a research article, but there's lots of really interesting examples, what she calls vignettes of children's play going on in it. So, I mean, it makes it interesting, you know, anything like that. It only needs colour photographs and it'd be really interesting. but of course, it's an academic article, so it doesn't have those. Yeah. But her call at the end of this article is, let us give play back to children rather than compensating them for its loss through intervention programmes. Mm. And you think, yeah.
Yeah.
Because actually, all this intervention that we have to do with children and families is because we're not giving them what they need, you know. And actually, what she's looking at is conflict resolution. Now, I have a particular thing about conflict resolution. Anyone who's been on any training that I've done will know that I find it really difficult to talk about communication and language without talking about conflict, because you don't need to make laminated problems to put in the block play for children to have problems. Yeah. I mean, where they need to use their language. Because my experience tells me that every single early years practitioner that I've ever met, and myself included,
yeah,
spends a lot of time dealing with conflict because it's difficult to get on with other human beings.
Yeah.
And when your social skills are developing, sharing and turn-taking and letting other people have things that you might want are really complicated things to be doing. So we do this all the time, but we can help children solve conflict by giving them the right, you know, not by going in like the UN and saying, right, if you two are going to be squabbling over that brush for the sand any longer, I'm going to push it away. Now, okay, there's a solution there in that, you know, the brush goes away, but the sand is still on the floor, and you've got two upset children who have not learned a single thing about how to use language to solve the problem or how to solve the problem. So, you know, there's lots of things going on in conflict resolution that is really important for children's development. And we should be actually, I think, doing a lot more work around that. And Pat does a really good job in that article of tying it in with play, because what she finds is that by observing closely what happens in children's play, we see that they actually have a sort of peace-loving and sort of frame of mind which wants to resolve things. They don't always have the skills, but they want to make things, because children want play to go on. They're very motivated in play. You know, a worksheet does not motivate in the same way playing with your mates does. I mean, sorry, but there's no way it's ever going to.
Well, you see that happening anyway, don't you? So,
well, exactly.
You know.
So, you know, she's talking there about how do we, from our observations, give children the right things in their play so that they can begin to resolve those things. Yes, there are interventions. I mean, I'm very keen, for instance, on High Scope's approach to conflict resolution, which is all about giving children the wherewithal to solve the problem. But she's saying, you know, actually, we need to not just look at the conflict, not just wait for the conflict to happen, but look at the provision and the ways in which we interact, and not just the opportunities for learning and the resources, but how we are, because we're a resource in the middle. We are the most powerful and wonderful resource that any child ever has, you know, the adults in their life.
Yeah.
And actually, what are we doing to make sure that children are getting the most out of their play, and the most being that getting those skills, and that we are there sensitively, not interrupting it, because we've all done that. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to sensitively intervene, and just as sensitively, I feel, realise I'm playing on my own, because actually, you know, they didn't want you there at that time. No.
Well, they do, I mean, they run away, don't they? They don't want you to intrude in there.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's, and she says, conflict resolution is not merely a matter of skill level, but exists within a broader frame of human experience, whereby stress and conflict may be intertwined. They are natural conditions which all adults and children experience to some degree. And this is what ties it in for me with what has been said about disadvantaged children, but which are experienced at especially high levels for children whose families live with poverty, low income, and high levels of day-to-day stress. Now, I used to work with lots of families encountering all of those things. Life is hard. It's not about blaming them for their life being hard. Actually, if we're going to blame anyone, I blame the government, particularly for the last 10 years of austerity, but, you know, I won't go there right now. But actually, if we think about it, therefore, we need to be very aware of it now, because children are going to be coming back into settings, or are coming into settings if they haven't ever been away, with a lot of stress in their lives, some of them, because of what's been going on with the pandemic. And if so, conflict will happen. And we need to make sure that actually we're thinking about that as part of our teaching role, not just as something we have to sort, which is a blooming nuisance.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think we need to just bear that in mind. And I think that article is a really good one in terms of getting us to think about that. I mean, there is a little bit of a summary of it in the review, and I could do a little summary of it to go with the podcast if that would be
helpful. Yeah, because I'm just mindful not everybody might have access to the
It's hard to get access to it because you need access to university library, and also as I say, you know, it's quite a read it's quite, you know, compared with many academic articles, it's very user friendly. But you know, I'm very happy to do a little summary So that's the one I would pick out, because I think that is just it covers play, how we interact with children, you know, who we are. I mean, you know, it's part of that whole business. I mean, you think about Jules Page's research about professional love and all that, you know, it ties in with all of those things. But also with language and the characteristics, thinking skills, getting children to be engaged and motivated and thinking about their learning. Is really important. And the review is important because it does for us a meta-analysis. In other words, you know, rather than us all having to go away and try and read all that research, because we've all got favourite bits of research, those of us who are vaguely academic, but actually it brings it all together in a really accessible format. And I think, you know, even if you don't read the whole thing, please be aware of it, because it helps us with arguments with people who don't get it.
Well, I'm definitely going to share it with your podcast. So people will have to, click through that to get through to the podcast. So there you go. So there is a way. You know,
I'm a great believer in there's always a way.
So this leads us on to our last couple of questions. So just quite briefly, what will we see from you in the future, Helen? What are we likely to see?
I think really just a sort of commitment to looking at what we're providing for children post-pandemic, because we don't want this to get lost. And unfortunately, the government are about to produce this review, and I will be on the case along with all these organisations, I'm sure. I mean, the thing that I try and do really is always, you know, accept invitations to talk about these things with people, because actually I've got the time to do the sorts of things like this, you know, having a look at things and summarizing them. And you know, because we will, post-pandemic is a really good time to sneakily introduce a whole new EYFS framework, isn't it, really? I mean, you know, I'm not accusing the government of having engineered the pandemic. That wasn't their fault, I have to say. But I mean, it just is very convenient in a way, because actually people are going to be so busy and so tired and stressed that they won't have time, you know, because you've got to make your priority the children, clearly. I mean, you know,
it's kind of bringing something through the back door instead of the front door. So
exactly. And you know, we have to remember that you know, the EYFS really is only a framework. It applies from birth to five, and we have to have the courage of our convictions to say we still, you know, regardless of what the government gets up to, we still know what's best for children. Yeah, and that research review is going to help us. So I'm going to be talking more about those sorts of things, I think.
Are we likely to see any new books from you? Or
you've touched a sore point now, Erin, because I'm working on the second edition of edited book that I did with a whole load of really great contributors on the characteristics of effective early learning. And we're having some new chapters in the second edition. Nancy and I are writing a chapter particularly on early language and the characteristics.
Right.
And Chris and Tony are doing a chapter for us on working with parents based on their high achieving white working class boys research, which is really interesting. And then the other contributors and various other people are actually writing new chapters or revising their chapters and things. So that's due to be, you know, with the publishers fairly soon. But you know,
We'll look forward to seeing that one.
I'm sure I'll be writing some more articles and things, but you know.
Good. Okay, so this leads us to our last question. Last but not least, I ask everybody, if I could grant you three wishes, what would they be?
Right, well, I had a good think about this, and I'm afraid they might be, it's sort of like, I've done three wishes, but they've got various sub-clauses to them. The first one is having a government which, you know, I really wish we had a government which values all citizens and the cultural capital they have to contribute to society. And therefore, government would be committed to seeing early childhood as an important stage in its own right and those young children as citizens. That's my first wish.
Great.
My second wish might be a bit controversial. I wish the government would in some way nationalise early years education and care, making it universal and free for all as part of a national network of children's centres in every locality.
Yeah.
Sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it? A children's centre.
Yeah, it does.
And that would be all graduate-led, and all early years professionals would be qualified to at least level 3 and all paid a decent salary and getting proper professional development.
Yeah.
In settings which are true learning communities for them and for the children and families they serve. And alongside that, childminders and other home-based care and education providers would be recognised as professionals on a par with all those out-of-home-based professionals. Yeah. I'm really passionate about that.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, that's all of my second wish, by the way. I know it sounds rather
boring.
And my third wish is that we have an EYFS based on a real appreciation and celebration of the complex and holistic nature of children's development and learning.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Oh, no, they're brilliant. And I think I love the second one, but I feel that we were getting there. we just need to. I think what I would say is, you know, I think, like you said, you mentioned that people are tired and, you know, but it's also important that we take on board everything that you've just talked about, making sure that we read the getting it right in the EYFS. I'll make sure that I, you know, give people the recommendations. So that it's quite easy to read, if that makes sense. And if you could do that, a review of the piece of research that you mentioned, then we can hopefully continue to get that message out there. So thank you so much, Helen. It's been an absolute delight speaking with you. And have you got any last words of wisdom that you'd like to share?
Oh, really? Just to say to everyone, stay strong. We are a brilliant sector. And actually, we have got the wherewithal to do amazing things for young children. And I see it happening every day. Those everyday miracles that happen in settings, despite whatever the government might be plotting. And actually, we are really good at what we do. And we just need to get better at it. And also, we need to call the government to account. And this is one way of doing that. So, you know, if you haven't got time to read it, don't worry, but just stay strong and stay doing those wonderful things with young children.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Helen. And everybody, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Bye, Helen.
Bye.